What is going on, Golden Hawks? We are back with another episode of Golden Bold. I'm joined today once again by Frankie. Me and Frankie are about to give you all the insights. Laurier, OUA, maybe some F1 today, Frankie.
Yeah, we're gonna change things up a little bit.
Set F1 season's coming up quick. That's we just right. Gotta get some talks and wheels. But you know, nonetheless, we gotta start with Laurier sports. Playoffs are well underway. For some Laurier teams, maybe a bit over.
Some, all but the women's hockey team have been eliminated in the first round of the playoffs, and the women's basketball team didn't even make the playoffs this year.
It's just super unfortunate. We were all on reading week. We're all taking some time off. Then we come back. We can't do an episode.
And we come back and everything's over. Like
it's all over. It's all gone. Men's basketball, it looked cooked right from the get-go. Lee Ben Odella, unfortunately, hurts his ankle against Brock, in, I believe right before halftime, and he was just out. And then you really cannot go to play a really good Ottawa team in Ottawa without one of your best players. And it's just, you look at a season like what they had, where they were competitive with a lot of these really good teams, and other nights they were not good against some teams they should probably have beaten. And you have this really up and down season, but I can't lie, the men's basketball team, I'm really excited to see. You were both first years. I'm really excited to see when they build in the next 3 years.
That's right. And there's something that head coach of the women's hockey team, Kelly Patton, said that goes for pretty much all of the OUA in terms of the sports that we cover, is that the talent gap is very close on every team. It could, there's obviously some teams that are way better than others. In the case of men's hockey, there's RMC and York, who are obviously weaker than some of the other teams in the program. But Laurier made the playoffs being 9-11. Or 9-12. That goes to show like how close it was. And those games that Laurier dropped were just in the fourth quarter or in like the penultimate moments of the first half. Like it was like they're very, very, very close games, and this season could have very well been like maybe 13-8 or 14-7 or even 8-12. Like it could have went either way for them. And I feel like Even if you're both Laurier basketball teams, men and women, you're not discouraged from the season you had. You taking it as, okay, that happened. What can we do now? Some of our seniors are graduating, yes. What can we do and who can we bring in to take that next step and secure the wins that you need to get a little bit higher seeding in the playoffs?
Yeah, you said it yourself. The talent gap isn't, you know, as wide as we see in some other leagues. It just really comes down to consistency. Like that's what really separates the teams like Carleton and TMU to teams like Laurier and Waterloo, like the teams that aren't as great and they can't, teams that don't really pull these double digit wins, is the consistency. And that's what I think Laurier, they're on the right step forward, especially for both the basketball teams. I'm excited to see some progression next season, because I don't think we can really handle, as Laurier basketball fans, even more heartbreak like what we saw from the men's team. It was like every game, you're going to lose by 2 points in the dying seconds of the game.
That's right. It's just, it was a little bit of a heartbreaking year. We had some ups and downs, a couple of good games where it looked like Laurier was gonna bring it out. There was one game that I called against U of T where they went down early in the first half. They started the second half really, really strong and then fell apart in the fourth quarter. And that was unfortunately a recurring theme throughout their season, where they would have decent enough games to pull away with a win, and then in the last 5 minutes they'd get tired and get sloppy and start fouling and end up the game having foul out a couple of your best players. And that's just not something that's ideal if you want to come away with last chance wins.
Yeah, it's just like sometimes they couldn't play a full four quarters, and if you can't play a full four quarters then in the OUA, you're going to get cooked more often than not. And it was just that. But I think Coach Cavell, he's going to have his guys next season. They're going to be, I feel like a lot of the team, they are coming back next year, at least a good portion of them. And you can rally around that, bring in some new guys, some fifth years maybe, and you can really rally around this. And hey, we built upon something this season. The season progressed. I think it progressed well for them. Let's see what they can do next season.
That's right. And we saw, speaking of basketball, it's a very familiar semifinal on both women's and men's, as it's going to be TMU and Carleton this weekend. on both sides of the ball. TMU just absolutely obliterated Windsor on home court, 97-38 on the women's side of the ball. So Nate, what are your predictions as TMU's come a little bit of an unproven program? They've been really good this year, but they don't really have the past success to back it. Carleton's a program that has won the women's basketball championship nationally and provincially a bunch of times over the last 15 or so years. What do you think? How do you think the kind of David and Goliath style strategy, how do you think that's going to affect TMU going into a game against a powerhouse like Carleton?
I really think this is a David and Goliath type of game. Like, TMU, you don't just walk into a semifinal game. It wasn't like some Cinderella story for Windsor, too. They were a three seed. They were a good team all season. You don't just blow a team out by almost 60 points in the semifinals for no reason. And if you ever, like, if you're around the TMU, like, basketball program or TMU sports programs, they rally around their program. Like, they absolutely love their team. And it's, I think, when it comes down to that, I feel like something like that passion when you're rallying around your team, like you go to their Instagram, just flooded with support. It's absolutely wild. You don't usually see that with OUA teams.
That's right.
And it's just, hey, if I'm going to bet on a team that has the like the total fan support from the program, from the school, it's TMU. Because I feel like it's a really exciting time to be a TMU Bulls fan. But once again, can you really bet against Carleton? They're the juggernaut. They're the evil team. They're the supervillain.
They're the evil empire.
Can you really bet against Carleton?
They are the New York Yankees of OUA women's basketball.
I mean, the Yankees are trash.
I meant the LA Dodgers.
Yeah, that's the
LA Dodgers. Better comparison.
It's like I want TMU to win, but can TMU beat Carleton?
Can they do it?
I hope they can do it. I think we're gonna have a close game. I don't think we're gonna have a 60-point walking, like we saw, but it should be close.
Yeah, I think so too. Speaking of passion and school spirit, to piggyback off what you said there, it's not something you see, especially with schools that have football programs and good football programs like Laurier does. The passion kind of like for their other sports teams gets a little bit sidelined and it gets pushed back a little bit, so you don't see as much. But that has absolutely changed with the rise of Laurier's women's hockey team. They have been good all year, 21-5, first in the OUA, number 4 in the country. They are the team from destiny. They, as it's been coined by our very own Mateo Beckles, Brock showed up to home ice yesterday and Laurier proved to them why you can't knock on the door, or you can't just knock on the door. You got to have a presentation ready to go. You can't just solicit stuff. And they walked in and Laurier showed them who's boss. And that's exactly what they needed to do. And it's the precedent that they needed to set, not just for Brock, but for all the other teams in this league that think maybe they have a chance, right? I believe this team can go far, but U of T did walk Ottawa in their game 6-3. And U of T has been a problem for this team all year. So I think if we can get past U of T, it's a very clear shot to a national championship berth.
Yeah, you could say that, but the thing with the Brock series, I'm no disrespect to Brock and their athletics program. They had a rough day yesterday all around for the entire program, but especially their women's team. That women's team currently is not just one tier down from the women's team, it's multiple tiers down.
That's right.
The Laurier women's hockey team is, in my opinion, on a tier of its own. In the OUA West, especially, you could really say maybe Guelph and Waterloo are right up there, maybe even a Queens from the East. But I don't think there's many teams that are as good as the Golden Hawks are have been this season. And the U Sports rankings prove that. It has been Laurier number one in the OUA for basically since all of 2026 has started, minus a few weeks where it looked like they might have been sputtering out of control, but they got it back on track. They beat Guelph in the final game of the season.
That's right.
Then Brock, I mean, that's the status quo.
I believe Brock came in limping, and they're not able to put up much of their fight. I saw a bunch of their team is injured. They have a lot of injuries. There were a lot of Badgers, bright red Badger hoodies in the crowd just not able to help or contribute for their team at all. They've had a couple of players. They had one player with a season-ending injury, undisclosed, obviously, but they've had some decent scoring. It's not their game, though. Their game isn't to put up huge numbers. So you're looking at the stats and you're thinking, what are they doing? But you're watching back their games. You watch back that play-in game against Windsor, and you're looking at it as this is a team that plays a heavy neutral zone game, reminiscent of like early 2000s dead puck era NHL. Like, you're thinking of this team plugs the middle. They block a lot of shots. Their goalie is very good for the year that she's had and the amount of games that she's played. Megan Thiessen is a very good goaltender, but Laurier was just able to exploit their sometimes sluggish changing. There was a little bit of defensive turnovers. They got a little bit too physical at times, and Laurier was just able to exploit that, and the pucks that needed to go in went in, and Laurier came out with a 3-0 victory, and they're going to go off to St. Catharines tomorrow and hopefully put this series away.
Yeah, putting the series away in St. Catharines, I feel like that's the most important thing to do, because there's no need for the Golden Hawks to play a back-to-back, a third game against a Brock team, especially when Brock, like, no offense, but Brock on his best day, like, they're not beating Laurier on their worst day. I feel that just the complete talent gap and overall, like, how systematically sound Laurier has been all season, it's once the Golden Hawks put 2+ goals against you, it's very hard to see them losing that game. Like, it's been rare instances when the Golden Hawks have scored 2+ and they've lost. They're not going to, like, they have the stranglehold against Brock, and it's unfortunate for the Badgers that you sneak into the playoffs, you win your play-in game, and then all of a sudden you have to play against the juggernaut. And I'm not calling them stepping stone, but there is bigger things for this Golden Hawks team to do. And I believe the standard that especially Kelly Patton has set is it's cup or bust for them. And I think that's the mentality of this team, is if you're not going to go all the way, what's the point of going at all?
That's right. And we did mention something on the broadcast last night that Kelly Patton did say, that the one seed was something that Laurier was looking for all year, because in the last couple of years, Laurier has been good, but they've only been good enough for the 2 or the 3 seed, and they're having to play a very competitive Waterloo team, and they were bounced in the quarters as a result. So getting the one seed is a huge accomplishment for them, and them being able to take it and run with it is something that they need to do. And moving over to the East, we have a little bit of perhaps a Cinderella run going on. Ontario Tech, the 5th seed, the final slot in the OUA playoffs. Or sorry, second to last. Brock was the final seed. But the second to last, the last spot in the East, went to Ontario Tech, who had a bit of a rocky start to their year, came back, won games that they needed to win, and they win their play-in game against Nipissing, who were a very good team all year. Very solid team in Nipissing. But Ontario Tech beat them, and Ontario Tech went into Queens and showed them who's boss, beating them 4-2 on the road. So, Nate, what do you think? What do you think of that? What do you think this is like? Is this like a Oakland 2024 March Madness situation with Jack Golke dropping 60? Like, is that like something we're seeing here? Perhaps a little Cinderella run?
I don't really think it's that type of Cinderella run. I've kind of been high on the Ontario. Like, if there was a team that was going to make a Cinderella run, in my opinion, I've been saying it for about a month now, it's going to be Ontario Tech on the women's side. I don't know, something about them, they just feel right for a Cinderella run. Like, Ontario Tech, it's a small school.
They're a newer program as well, so, like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it just felt like, if I were to look at a team, it's like, yeah, Ontario Tech makes sense. I've been joking with Mateo, like, hey, I wouldn't be surprised to see Ontario Tech on this Golden Hawks run for the Macaw Cup. I would not at all be surprised. It'd be funny, because the Golden Hawks have blown the doors off Ontario Tech the entire season.
That's true. And you don't expect a team that's getting pumped 5 goose every time you come into town. You don't expect a team like that to make a deep playoff run, but they beat the number 8 team in the country when they were nowhere near the power rankings all year. So you got to take that and you're like, whoa, they might mean business.
Yeah, and with hockey itself, like, whoever gets hot at the right time is going to win a game. And if Ontario Tech, they've head full of steam, you beat, like, Nipissing, you can really call them, like, that's their rival, kind of. Ontario Tech, Nipissing, that's kind of the rivalry. You beat them in a play-in round, then you go to Queens, you win that game. They got all the momentum in the world. You got to win one of the next 2 against Queens. One of them's coming back home. And you have your sights set. If I'm Ontario Tech, you're 60 minutes away, really, from a semifinal appearance, and that's huge for the program. Granted, it's probably going to be against a powerhouse team, but you already, if you take down a Queens, I think anything's happening. They're playing with house money right now versus a Queens team, where if you get bounced by Ontario Tech, you can be tight. All the pressure's on your back. Versus a team with house money, that's dangerous.
That's right. If it's Ontario Tech and Queens, that's the matchup. I mean, that's like, that's it, really. I mean, and then you have Waterloo and Guelph, who was a really close game. Guelph took an early 2-0 lead, an early 4-1 lead at the end of the second, and Waterloo came back, put them to within one goal, but ultimately weren't able to really capitalize. But now Waterloo has the opportunity at home to really to make the final push for that final spot. So I believe the more difficult matchup in the semifinals is going to be, so if we were to do a little bit of a prediction round, mm-hmm. for the semifinals of the Macaw Cup and eventual winner, we're going to lock it in now.
All right.
We're going to do my prediction, and then we're going to go hear Nate's prediction.
All right.
So my prediction is Laurier takes down U of T in an epic final third game. They move to the Macaw Cup final against Ontario Tech, because Ontario Tech is going to beat either Waterloo or Guelph. And I think it's Guelph. I think it's Waterloo that's going to make the push. And I think, both of these semifinal series will come down to three games. Both of them will. I believe each team is going to take their home game. I think that's very, very possible, because Laurier has not been able to win at Varsity Center all year. That's true. So I think it'll be Laurier U of T semifinal, and then Ontario Tech Waterloo semifinal, and the final will be Laurier Ontario Tech in the Macaw Cup.
I think we're similar onto what we're thinking right now, but yeah, I don't like Ottawa is probably the sneakiest third seed ever. Ottawa is not a very good team, so I think Toronto does take them down. If not two, it's going to be three, and then Laurier beats Brock. That's my semifinal on one side. I do think Queens eventually just take down Ontario Tech. I think Ontario Tech doesn't have the wheels to take out Queens. It'd be a major upset if they do, but I don't think they have it like to beat them now two more times in a row, especially with the travel.
I'm a huge believer in the David knocking out Goliath with the stone between the eyes. I'm a huge believer in that.
I don't know. I'm not sure if they have the wheels. I'm not sure if they have the wheels. And with that Guelph-Waterloo series, I think this is the best series of the playoffs. It's going to be, like, especially for the quarterfinals, the best series. The only thing is, like, I'm concerned. Waterloo can beat teams like Laurier and Guelph, because Guelph was a very similar game to Laurier.
That's true. They are very similar, defensively and offensively.
And Waterloo's a very fast team, and they're aggressive on the penalty kill. If it's going to come down, whoever wins game two is going to win game three, like to win the series, I feel.
I believe so.
I think it's going to be Waterloo.
I agree with you.
I'm a believer in Waterloo. I think we're going to get Waterloo-Queens. I think Queens is structured well enough to beat Waterloo at the end. I think Waterloo's a bit risky. I think Queens-Laurier, I feel like that's what we've been building towards for the entire season. I feel like Laurier was going to take them down in three, and it's going to be a super competitive series.
I think once Laurier gets out of the OUA, then the real challenge starts, because those teams in the RESC and Canada West, you have the juggernaut UBC, who I think has lost maybe two games all year. You have Concordia, who won last year. You have New Brunswick. You have STFX. You have those huge teams on the opposite side of the country that really are going to be a test to the eventual Macaw Cup winner. It's going to be a huge test and a very competitive. This is a great year for women's hockey in Canada and even in the professional side of things. It's a great year for women's hockey. It's just been great hockey all year. I think it's going to be the most entertaining.
It should be. But for Laurier, they have, I think, one major advantage. If I'm not mistaken, I believe Nationals are in Elmira. I'm pretty sure it's Elmira, Ontario, which is a 30-minute drive from Waterloo.
If that's the case,
I'm pretty sure I've been to the arena too.
Student session's going to be buzzing.
I've been to the arena too for U14 AA hockey. It's a nice arena. And if that's the case, Laurier's got the home ice advantage.
Pretty much, yeah.
None of these teams are within thousands of kilometers from that arena.
That's right.
And you're 20. It's going to be your year. You got your best team you're ever going to have in program history. With home ice advantage in Nationals, this you got to make it the year. This has got to be the year.
This is the year. This is the year.
Do you want to talk about Laurier men's hockey? I really don't. I watched them get eliminated.
So for the men, I believe this was a learning opportunity. This season, whole season was a learning opportunity. You start off hot 6-0 at the beginning of the year. People are calling this the turnaround of the year, and you fall apart. It's just unfortunate because you did not win the games you needed to win. We had a little bit of goaltending trouble near the end of the year with Andrew Ness being injured and an unproven Vinislav, I'm probably going to butcher his name.
Shingarov,
yeah. Him coming in and playing the last couple games of the year. He did a good enough job holding the fort, but just wasn't able to get it done when you needed to. And I think with the seniors that are leaving, it's a time to maybe give the younger guys a chance and maybe have a couple of rebuilding years. Ultimately, you don't want to hear that if you're a sports fan, but it might be time to revisit your systems and revisit your players and really think about what you want to do and where you want to take this program, because obviously what's going on right now isn't working.
Yeah, it just looked like in that game 3, do or die, win or go home, against Guelph, they've seen this team 4 times in a week. They looked flat. They looked like they wanted to go to Cancun. Like, that was the type of vibe I got, because I just wasn't understanding. Like, your season's on the line, and you put up a 0 shutout against Guelph. As Guelph, it's 2-0. They put in the 2 empty netters, 4-0 loss. But like, I just didn't understand any of the strategy. Coach Forrest, like, you have Max Antoine Lelanson and Lucas Chart should have been playing on the power play together. I don't get why. It's your best playmaker with your best goal scorer. Why are they being separated on a power? And then, like, especially when you're down 2-0, why are you separating them on a power play? I've said it all over the broadcast. Like, why are they being separated? They looked good together. Like, they were together for 20 seconds, and it was the best offensive chances that we had all game. But I don't think we're cooked for the future. I really don't. Like, Travis Verbeek, that guy's a phenomenal player.
That's right.
He plays hard.
I think he's one of the guys that you're gonna have to build around. I think he's him and whatever you got left out of Lucas Chard. I think that's what you focus on and that's what you build on. You build on your defensive anchors. You've got Kai Stuthers still for another year. You've got David Paglia now for a few years, and you've got guys like that, Anthony Franchella, that can really turn into the core members of your team and really become leaders in your locker room.
Yeah, it's just they have the major big pieces. Andrew Ness is probably going to stick around a little longer, hopefully.
That's right. It was only his first year of eligibility. You've got him for a few years.
Yeah, and so you got the big pieces. It's time to fill it out with some recruiting class guys, maybe some guys coming in to Laurier, maybe some BBA guys that want to, you know, those guys get the hockey BBA like connection. But I think Laurier should be in a decent position going forward. It was a decent year. It's better than 5 wins last year. It's a first round exit against a Guelph team. They played hard. It was, for the most part, they played hard. Not the way you want to end it, but still a positive step forward.
That's right. I think we move on to a never before talked about topic on the Golden Bold podcast.
We have to. We had to talk about F1. It's been just so intriguing. New regulations, new rules, everything. It just seems like every new week comes with a new headline.
It's not looking bright, I don't think. This season, these regulations have already caused a lot of backlash. As an Aston Martin fan yourself, you see Fernando Alonso comparing it to a boat because the cars don't drive well and the drivers don't like it. Hamilton even said in an interview, he said that it's going to be more difficult for the fans to understand because it takes a person with an engineering degree to even begin to understand what's going on with these cars.
They're overcomplicated.
You have your V6 turbo hybrid, which we've proven isn't working as an engine. We have your new aerodynamic rules. You've increased the weight of the cars. You've decreased the amount of fuel they can actually have in the cars. You've put more reliance on your electrical power unit, which already isn't working. And the aero is just getting worse. It's getting a lot more downforce heavy, and these cars have no give. The second they get off their line or off their preferred air track, it's over. You're sent flying into a wall.
Yeah, it's just like if I want to watch Formula E, I would watch Formula E.
Exactly. Formula E is funny. They have the fan boost, which I think is really cool, where fans can vote mid-race for a driver they want to give a boost to, and the driver gets like an extra 10% of their battery that they could just use.
It's such a gimmick sport, but it's so funny.
It's so much fun to watch. I can't even lie to you.
But it's just like, why? Like, you didn't need to, like, I understand you wanted to make it more wheel-to-wheel racing. You wanted to make the car smaller, especially for races like Monaco, which, like, if it were being real, that race shouldn't be on the calendar anymore. It's so boring.
I think that Monaco can work if you make the cars narrower. I think the cars are too wide. They are narrower than they were in, like, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, all the way up to 2023. 2022
mm-hmm.
or 2021, those were the widest the cars have ever been. And okay, those were good cars. Don't get me wrong. 2017 was a great year. But I think if you go back to a more 2010 to 2016 style of car, Monaco can work. Because that decrease in width allows for two cars to fit on the main straight of Monaco instead of just one. But I think Monaco is a good race to test the drivers that have the balls to move, to make a move on that small of a track.
Lance Stroll. If you watch his Monaco tapes, sometimes when he wants to turn to Lance Senna Stroll, he turns into Lance Senna Stroll.
You know his allowance? I'm calling it an allowance. That's what I'm calling his F1 career, an allowance. Because he's getting paid $12 million. His dad is giving him $12 million a year. That's an allowance. That's like my dad giving me $20 to cut mine on his grass. Like that's the same vibe I'm getting here. I think he shouldn't be an F1. I think there are plenty of other drivers. I think Felipe Drugovic should have that seat instead of him and should be learning from Fernando Alonso. And then I think if that happens, because Drugovic is a great driver. We saw him in F2. He's a great driver. Bortoleto's a little bit better, but Bortoleto got his F1 seat. Now you have to give one to Drugovic. And I think if you get Drugovic that seat in Aston Martin and he learns from Alonso, he can be a championship contending driver when he's in his prime.
I don't think Lance is the worst driver on the grid.
I don't think he's the worst.
I think Kalle Pinto, I don't have no clue that Kalle Pinto was on this grid.
Okay, Kalle Pinto was a hot candidate for the Alpine seat because he did very good stuff in some endurance categories and other junior formula stuff, but he didn't have enough of an F2 career to really develop the open wheel skills that he needed.
He's either slow or he finds the barrier every race. That's the thing with Kalle Pinto. Yes, he's either like, if he's fast, he's gonna crash, or he's like miles off the pace.
I agree.
Like Kalle Pinto, I've never understood in the seat. I didn't understand why they moved on from Doohan. I understand Doohan was
I think as bad as Kalle Pinto is, he is a better pick than Jack Doohan.
It's bad between the two.
It's bad or bad, but then again you have to look at who brings the most sponsor money, and I think because it's like Sergio Perez.
Oh yeah.
He's got an entire country backing it. Like he's got billions of taxpayer dollars backing him in his F1 career because he's buddy buddy with the Prime Minister, President of Mexico.
And Kit Kat.
So I think it's the same thing with Kalle Pinto because he's the only Argentinian driver. He's the first Argentinian driver to drive an F1 since Juan Manuel Fangio in like 1952. So I feel like it's a similar situation where he's got the whole country behind him, kind of like Guan Yu Zhou had the whole country behind him because there's never been a Chinese driver in F1 before. Again, he's another guy that everyone thought was going to be horrible and came in and did some good things. Like he had a couple of good races. He put a horrible Sauber car in 11th or 12th, which is saying something.
It was him and Bottas. I remember that entire season was just like, Okay, can Bottas and Guan Yu Zhou finally get some points? I think they finally got like the last
race. I think Bottas was the only one that got any points.
I think it was Zhou.
Might have been.
I remember Bottas had the worst luck that season.
Bottas, yeah, that was Bottas's worst season, and then he just fully left F1. Now he's back.
I think I like Cadillac.
I feel like they're going to be not as good as 2009 Braun. They're not going to win the championship, obviously, but I feel like they might sniff top five.
Ooh, I don't think about that.
I think in a crazy like a wet race where everybody's messed up and there's a Red Bull in 17th, which might happen anyway, but there's like Antonelli's in like 18th, and then you have Hamilton in like 14th, and then you've got like Fernando Alonso in 3rd, and then you've got Valtteri Bottas or Sergio Perez in like 5th. Like it's going to be one of those. Like it's going to be like George Russell coming 2nd in a wet spa, like that kind of a thing, you know?
It could be that type of thing, but like it's...
That's what I'm thinking, if Cadillac's going to do anything.
If Aston isn't sandbagging, which I hope they're sandbagging, like there's no way... Like how are you 4 seconds off the pace with Adrian Newey? Like the Honda engine
it's the regulations, and it's 100% the Honda engine.
Oh, yeah.
It's 100% the Honda engine. I think the second that... They told, like, I can imagine the Aston Martin driver meeting when they're telling him, guys, we're bringing in the Honda engine. I can just hear Fernando Alonso screaming from across the Atlantic Ocean.
I don't get it. Like, Honda was running with Red Bull the last couple of years, too.
Because Red Bull's engineering department is one of the best in racing ever. That's why they're making their own engines.
Now they got the Ford EcoBoost engine.
Not even the Ford EcoBoost engine. It's just their technology. It's all Red Bull's engineers. Red Bull's engineers have built the power unit for the last 2 years. They just bring in parts. It's just parts. Red Bull does all the manufacture themselves, which is why I think they were able to make the Honda engine good. McLaren, when they had the Honda engine in like 2014,
garbage.
They just said, "Hey Honda, give us your 2007 Formula One engine, we'll put a turbo on it and call it a day." And then Fernando Alonso compared it to driving a Formula Two car, which is exactly what it was, because that car got like 2 points all year.
I feel like this is what these 2026 regulations are like.
They're boats.
I can't imagine this car driving at Monza. I feel like the battery's just gonna give out halfway down a street.
Yeah. There's gonna be, I think this year will be the first time we see a car retire from the race from running out of fuel.
Really?
I think that will happen. One time. It will happen at least one time, and they'll be like, okay, we're done. But I feel like the president of the FIA, I don't even know what his name is.
Mohammed bin Salam.
Yeah, that guy. I feel like with his, not to get too political, but like with his like Saudi oil thing, he's going to get rid of all this hybrid electric stuff. I feel like the next F1 engine regulation will be either a V8 or a V10. I think we're going back.
They came out and said, I don't think V10. Probably be some V8 like turbo.
I'm gonna guess a V8 turbo.
I think it's gonna be V8 turbo. It has to go back. Like I don't know. Like it's basically like 50% battery is outrageous in my opinion. Like you cannot have a 50%. Like how are you gonna run 50% electrical and like some of the most powerful engines in the world?
I think that when F1 introduced the kinetic energy recovery system in 2008 and 2010. Those were probably the best years.
The curbs.
Because it's a very innovative system and it makes a lot of sense. You generate the heat from your brakes, you put it back into the engine to use as battery power, which makes sense. Because you feel like all of the temperature that these cars, these brakes are going up to 1,000 degrees Celsius when they're braking. That's why you see the fire come out sometimes. Because I feel like that's the best way. If you're going to do a hybrid energy recovery system, that's the best way to do it, is kinetically. You can't just tell your car to just make electrical energy out of nothing.
Yeah, it's...
Like you can't do that.
It's disgusting. I never liked the regulations, because I'm a big fan of like the 2022-25 regulations. Mm-hmm. I like the way those cars looked. I think those are like some of the best looking cars.
They were very good looking, yes, but
they were boats.
They're boats. They can't move.
And just like this year is like it's basically whoever comes down to the best engine, in my opinion. It's the Mercedes engine. I'm pretty sure it's going to be that Mercedes. Mercedes looked ultra reliable. They ran into some
reliable
problem.
Yes,
I think that's what it's going to come. I think it's what it's going to come down to. Who's the most reliable?
I think that is also what it's going to come down to. But you can't talk about an engine without talking about the prancing horses, because that's what Ferrari's good at. Is building engines. That's what they can do. That's why they're so good in WEC and in endurance racing and in GT and in literally everything else other than F1, because it's all about the engine. You build a car with a phenomenal engine, you get phenomenal results. The only sport where that's not true is F1, because F1 is 90% aerodynamics and driver politics, because it's aerodynamics in the sense that having raw engine power can't win you races anymore. It can't. That's true. Because if that's the case, Ferrari would have won the last 5 years in a row. Because the Ferrari engine is the strongest on paper every year, but it's not. It's the reliability that kills them.
And their aero packages suck. They put
exactly.
They're generating lift on their reverse back wing, reverse rear wing.
We're gonna see Lewis Hamilton's F1 car serving chicken shawarma in 6 years because it's just rotating. The rear wing is just rotating. Why is the rear wing upside down? DRS doesn't even exist anymore. Why is the rear wing open at all?
I feel like they're just trying to generate more, like they came out and said, oh, we're trying to generate lift.
Why are we generating lift on a race car?
Make the car, like, you don't need downforce on a straight, so you need to get the car up, make it go faster. And that, I feel like they brought a bunch of their WEC engineers over for this year, for this regulations. Yeah, that could be some of the crazy stuff.
WEC is a different ball game, man. You can't. An F1 engineer is an open wheel engineer. You cannot bring. I love WEC, but it's closed wheel racing. It's prototype. It's a completely different ball game. A WEC aero package, even if it's slightly adjusted to compensate for an open wheel package, will not work. A WEC aero package will not work in Formula One. You need a Formula One. You need an open wheel aerodynamics expert to work on your car, and that's why I think you bring in a little bit of IndyCar, because that's open wheel racing. Sure, they do oval sometimes, but the road course cars are different than the oval cars. They're completely different. Spoiler: the rear wing angle changes. The front wing angle changes. The diffusers are different. There's the little thingies on the side that those don't exist anymore. But speaking of IndyCar, how do we feel about Colton Herta in F2?
Don't hate it. I feel like IndyCar is. Especially for an American style like racing,
it's very good.
I love it. I love IndyCar. Like, IndyCar has easily blown NASCAR out of the way and their broken point system. Like, NASCAR playoff. It's the most confusing thing to understand.
Yes, yes, of course. I finish fifth, but I get 38 points. But the guy who finished seventh gets 42 because he came first 50 laps ago, because he was in first 50 laps ago.
Yeah, it's like, there's enough. The regular season doesn't matter. What?
No, they have a new playoff system. It's the Chase now.
Yeah, but for the last like 10 or so years, it's been
not good. But garbage. The chase actually works.
Yeah,
that's a playoff system that works. I feel like the regular season needs to change. We need to get rid of the stage system, because why am I, as a fan, why am I? It's like watching a hockey game. Racing is like NASCAR is like watching a hockey game now. There's three periods. Why are there three periods in a car race?
It's so manufactured. They just manufacture like
it is. They manufacture violence and they manufacture photo finishes because they try to bunch everybody up at the end with false cautions, which happens a lot.
Yeah,
it's how do you think there were four last season? There were four finishes in under 0.2 seconds.
Like, that's not right.
Every finish can't be the beginning of Cars 1 where Lightning McQueen sticks his tongue out. Like, that cannot happen every race because it's just going to get boring.
Yeah, if you have a buzzer beater at the end of every basketball game, like, oh, it's...
Well, it loses its novelty, right? Yeah. Exactly. And I feel like with F1, there's not enough of that novelty.
No, it's
because,
just...
Because the car that's in first is in first by 45 seconds, and then you have... And then you have the commentators going, oh, let's look over here. Let's look at Lance Stroll and Alex Albon fighting for 14th, because that means anything. You don't get points for 14th.
They're good at it. They're good at, like, that's one of their strategies when they, for the boost of F1 popularity, they don't focus. They just focus on the battles. Even though it's meaningless, it's entertaining. Like, do I want to watch Max Verstappen pissing off 30 seconds to the distance?
Because the F1 championship doesn't matter anymore. It's just that it's just those two guys that are going to win every race. And oh, look at that. They're within 20 points of each other with five races to go. One of those two guys retires one race, the championship is all but won. and that's how it's going to happen. Last year was one of the most interesting title fight since 2021.
Yeah, and all it took was
and 2021 was manufactured. Was a manufactured win for Verstappen. Cuz that yellow flag rule, it's what got Stefano Domenicali fired. And he came, or Michael Massey, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
But I think that will never happen again because I don't think that guy can leave his house anymore. Hamilton should have that eighth title. I think that yellow flag safety car where he just let Verstappen by everybody. I don't know why. I don't remember why, and I don't care to relearn it.
This is the championship. We go racing.
Yeah.
No, but here's the thing. Hamilton should have won Abu Dhabi.
He should have.
Verstappen still should have won the championship. Like, Hamilton was playing...
Hamilton was playing
Massacre Verstappen all the way through Silverstone.
But if Hamilton wins Abu Dhabi, he wins the championship.
No, but there's other parts in that 2021 season that, like, Hamilton caught a lot of favoritism during... Like, he tried to kill his opposition in Silverstone.
Look, I love...
Turn the tides of the championship.
I love... Michael Schumacher. Hey, Michael Schumacher did the same thing in 94 when he won his title.
That's Michael Schumacher. We're talking 1994 racing.
Hey.
Where, like, hey, I know he would
the
break.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. They're both 7-time world champions. They're both the most successful driver from their country. And they're both the reason that their team is revered in such a high light. Ferrari, yes, has the history. But when you think of Ferrari, who's the first driver you think of?
Michael Schumacher.
Thank you. And the Ferrari 2004 and how beautiful it sounds. But that's what I thought of. I'm like, oh my God, he's doing a Schumacher because he's trying to crash him out.
Now Verstappen plays that game.
It's frustration. Like when you're driving, when you're in that mode, you have to be so laser focused that the slightest bit of frustration could mean the life or like a devastating injury to you or the person you're trying to hurt.
I think the cars are too safe for that now. Like, you see what these guys do in these cars. Like, if you saw what Doohan did, you saw Bortoleto's done.
That's right.
Yuki Tsunoda, like every other weekend was throwing himself into the barriers.
But you rarely see a driver get hurt anymore. And where you see drivers get hurt, you see them in endurance series and like in WEC and in IMSA and in touring car. Like in touring car last year, there was a race where I was at an event. And I was watching a Michelin Pilot Challenge at CCMP, and it was three wide down the back straight, an Audi touring car, a Hyundai touring car, and a BMW GT4. So the BMW GT4 has the right of way because it's in the higher class, so they have to let him by. So the BMW comes in, the Hyundai gets spooked and bumps into the Audi, causing the Audi to come across and take out both those cars. And I think that was the first time that I had seen a driver get that heavily injured. He broke two ribs and had a concussion, the driver of that Audi. And I think that's the first time a driver's been that seriously injured, but which is good because it just shows how safe everything is now. But then again, there's the opposite side of the coin where, oh, everything's safe. I'm just going to purposefully drive into this guy.
Yeah, there's no like, hey, if I crash, we die anymore.
It's not like there's not that level of fear anymore because these guys have grown up in... A thing where an F1 car can have five London Tower buses on top of it and not break.
It's a thing to say. If you never want to see anyone get seriously injured,
of course,
it basically has to be a freak accident now.
Of course not. Yeah, it has to be an insane accident for anybody to come out with.
Like
even
Roman Grosjean.
Roman Grosjean is the highest example.
Yeah,
but that's only because of where the fuel tank is placed in those cars.
And like how he hit,
the barrier. It was a very freak accident. He went into the barrier and the car split in half, causing the fuel tank to explode.
Yeah.
That's why the fire was started. If the fuel tank is even further back or even like low in the bottom, like it is in most cars, in most race cars, it's in a very secluded location. But because of where it was in that 2021 car, when the car split in half and it caused it to explode.
Yeah, and even the halo, like, it protected him from the barriers.
The halo, also, Charles Leclerc in 2018.
Yeah.
Fernando Alonso comes flying over the top of him. And if there's no halo, his head comes clean off.
Joe Guanyu crashed into the Verstappen. Saved a lot of lives.
Saved a lot of lives. And I believe that the halo should be universal in all open wheel racing IndyCar's little windscreen, I don't think it makes sense.
It's a windscreen halo, I think.
Kind of, but then why are you going to put the screen?
I think it's the screen, so you don't have to have the bar in front of you.
I think the screen, but then it negates the purpose of the halo. The whole point of the halo is that the bar takes most of the force. If you just have the floating thing there, it's going to snap.
I think the screen's like the support there too. Like, because I remember F1 was there when they were trying to introduce the halo, they were messing around with the windscreen.
They were messing
around. The only thing with the windscreen, the windscreen looks so ugly on an F1 car.
It does.
And so they pivoted away from it.
I don't think it looks right on the IndyCar either.
It doesn't look as bad as it does because IndyCar is smaller.
Yes.
It looks okay.
Of course, yes.
On the IndyCar. Mm-hmm. It looks awful on, like, I remember Daniel Ricciardo, the videos of Daniel Ricciardo came out when he was testing the windscreen. It looked awful.
Yeah, it didn't.
No, not at all. But, like, even to F1, like, yeah. What do we think? Like, I have no gauge. This is, like,
what do we think? First race of the season, do we think it's a run-of-the-mill, or do we think it's going to be an insane slugfest and we see an unexpected first winner?
I think with these type of cars, when you don't know what you're going to get, like, I don't think every car is even this season.
Not at all.
No, there's some bad cars, but we don't really know who's good. I think the Red Bull is going to be decent this year. The Mercedes, the McLaren, Ferrari, those are going to be good cars. Yep. If the Ferrari aero package is decent, it's going to be Charles Leclerc all season long.
I think so too.
But I can't count on Max Verstappen. Verstappen can make a tractor. You can put that on the podium.
You can't count. Yeah, you can never count out Max Verstappen. You can. But what you can count on, though, is Isaac Hadjar to be in the bottom of that group.
Really?
In the bottom of that group. If you're talking about between the top four teams, the top eight cars on the grid, Isaac Hadjar will be eighth 9 times out of 10.
No.
I think so, too. I think that only because the second Red Bull seat is cursed.
It is cursed, but I think Hamilton's just fried.
I think Hamilton will do a little bit better.
He should do a little bit better.
Okay. If those top four teams, we'll go top eight.
Yeah.
We'll go number one, I'll say Norris.
Norris.
I'll take Norris at number one and Piastri number two.
Wow.
Okay. Norris, Verstappen, Piastri. Done.
Okay, yeah.
We'll take Russell 4,
mm-hmm.
Leclerc 5,
mm-hmm.
Antonelli 6,
okay.
Hamilton 7, Hadjar 8.
Are we talking pure driver skill? Or are we just talking like with the car?
With the car and everything and whatever. I think that's what it'll be.
All right, let me go mine. I think Verstappen's number one. You can give that guy.
That's true.
Verstappen 1, mm-hmm. Russell 2, Piastri 3, Leclerc 4, Norris 5.
You didn't think Norris is going to drop that hard off after winning the title?
I think he had a lucky season overall. Like, he had a good season or whatnot. But took Piastri, like, having one of the worst second halves I've ever seen in my life.
That's right.
And he's still, if Antonelli knows how to defend in the second to last race, and, like, how do you, you're one lap, just defend 2 seconds for one lap.
You can't fault him for that. Antonelli's 18, Antonelli's 19 years old. You can't fault him for that.
If he had two, he was 2 seconds up on Norris, and he shunts it. Second to last lap, and then Yuki Tsunoda, I'm going to defend like a lion.
Yuki Tsunoda.
I'm going to defend like a lion for my Max Verstappen, and he takes a 5 second penalty without slowing Norris down. Like, at least shunt him off the track to keep your job in F1.
That's true. Poor guy. I think he's a reserve driver.
I think he is. It's just, it makes sense. Like, I was super high on Tsunoda.
I really like Arvin Lindblad.
Yeah, I would, but it was just like odd man out.
I that's true, but like, I really like Arvin Lindblad. I think he's going to do really, really well.
Isaac Hadjar's got that seat up. He's on the hot seat already.
It's on fire. It's already on fire.
It's
like, I feel bad for the guy, but I think Arvin Lindblad is going to do numbers in that Racing Bulls car. And it was competitive last year.
It was not really. It was like the second to worst. It seemed competitive, but it was, I think.
They were putting up bottom points.
I think they finished
every two or three races.
Did they finish ninth last season? No. I think
Aston Martin was worse.
No, Aston Martin was better.
No, come on.
We should check this whole check.
We'll do a little bit of a stat check. I think the Racing Bulls was more competitive than people think it was.
Because I remember looking at the standings, like, because I remember Racing Bulls being better. Team standings. No, it's constructors. Ferrari, Williams.
Yeah, RB was
6. Oh, RB was 6. I was thinking of Sauber.
Yeah. And then Alpine last, Haas in 8th. I like Haas.
I do like Haas. I think Haas is going to be pretty good. Haas is going to be sneaky competitive this year.
Sneaky competitive. They might sneak a top 5.
I think Ollie Bearman's going to be surprising this year.
Yeah.
Like, he's a good driver. He's probably the... I think he's... the best of his class, rookie class.
I think so too.
Like, because Antonelli has the best, he's got the best car under him.
That's right. It's like, it was like 2019. The 2019 rookies, McLaren and Mercedes, and then Williams. Like, poor Albon, what is he going to do in that Williams car?
Hey, man, he can slap it. No, Albon's cooked a little bit right now. So, like, I think he was...
Oh, no, sorry. It was Russell, because Russell
in the Williams, because Albon was a Red Bull driver.
Albon was Toro Rosso, then Red Bull, yeah. Because Pierre Gasly absolutely pooped to bed.
And everyone has in that seat, except for, like, Checo Perez for, like, half a season.
Yeah, he was okay.
And then, like, you really think about it, like, I don't know how to feel about, like, Ollie
Barron. The only person who didn't poop in that second Red Bull seat was Daniel Ricciardo.
Even Daniel Ricciardo started getting cooked. Like, no, he brought
he
back.
He was never getting cooked. He left on his own accord.
And what a mistake. He went to Renault.
That was a mistake.
And then, like, he was supposed to come back to the Red Bull seat, and then he couldn't do nothing in RB.
Yeah, no.
He was getting fried by Yuki.
Getting fried. And then, now I think he's a Ford Racing ambassador, so I think he does, like, their, like, I don't know, off-road stuff. I don't know.
An American and whatnot. He's been... like Mr. America
Proud
F1 driver
to be
for a while.
An American, even though he's from Australia.
Speaking of the Americans, I know. Oh yeah, I've had to. We had to talk about it.
What, the Olympics?
We had to talk about it eventually. Like Nathan MacKinnon, wide open neck, game on the line.
Oh, it's horrible. But I feel like that wasn't the kicker for the game. I feel like the kicker for the game was Thomas Hartley's turnover in overtime. Just taking that shot and a huge block. By I think it was Jack Eichel. Huge block to get the 2-on-1 going, and then Jack Hughes is wide open.
It felt like the first time all Olympics where the worst team won.
The worst team won, yeah.
Like that US team, like on paper, is not that good.
You could say the women's was the same thing.
No, the women's US team. Like,
I like the Canadian women's team.
The Canadian women's team is a retirement home. Like they brought like
a retirement home. What are you talking about?
It was a bunch of Asian stuff. Like the US team it's their time, because the Canadian roster was not built like. It was a lot of like
their stars are older. That's the problem. It's not the team that's older.
It was a lot of last gasps.
Their stars are older. Like Marie-Philippe Poulin, Natalie Spooner, Sarah Nurse. They're on the older side. Yes. Yeah. That's your big names. But you got players like, you got like Emma Malte. You got like Laura Stacey. You got Fillier. Like, actually, I don't even know if Fillier is Canadian, but I'm just thinking of, but they were good. They were good, and they played clean games. I just feel like at the end of the day, Megan Keller drove the shot home that she needed to, and they won.
Yeah, but like they won 5-0 in the round robin prelims rounds, and like I felt like even when Canada went up 1-0, it didn't feel safe. And once the U.S. tied it, like you can kind of see the writing on the wall. They were the Canadians just nursing that lead for like half that game, and it was just like, yeah, it felt like the younger, faster team, like that U.S. team could skate. And that was it. And then the men's team, Jack Hughes.
Oh, man.
The Jack Hughes went to high school.
Stole Canada's medal and Canada's girl.
Jack Hughes went to high school 20 minutes away from me. I don't know why he's even on that team.
Well, okay. Well, he was born in the States, raised in the States. He only went to high school here because he played for the Toronto Marlboros.
Oh, like, all right, buddy. Your whole career is basically here. Like, you might as well play on a super team.
He played two seasons in U16 AAA and then left.
Might as well, you know.
He never. It's not like he played in the OHL. I don't even know.
Might as well be out here.
He played for the national development team. He didn't even play like college or anything.
I'm pretty sure the Hughes brothers and the Nylander brothers like lived together in Canada.
Maybe.
I'm pretty sure.
I don't know for sure.
I remember seeing pictures of little Nylander with little Hughes.
Yeah, but like they're like really. How? They're so far apart. Nylander played in Europe.
I think Nylander came to the O, or Alex Nylander.
Alex Nylander. And
Alex Nylander played with the
Maybe
Steelheads.
Maybe Alex Nylander.
I think William did come over eventually.
No, but William played in Europe. He was born in Canada. He was born in Calgary.
I just remember seeing a picture on Instagram. Hold up.
He was born in Calgary and played hockey in Europe with David Pastrnak. He played in Czechia with David Pastrnak. They were on the same junior team. Yeah, okay.
That's them. That's William.
With Quinn, yeah.
And then these are the little boys.
With Jack and Luke, yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay, so it wasn't Alex. So where did this picture get taken?
I don't know.
Living. Oh, yeah, in Toronto.
Okay, yeah, that's after he was drafted.
Hey, Look at this. This is Team Canada. This should be Team Canada's future. Oh my
god. Yeah, they're all American.
Austin Matthews, Captain America, come back to Toronto and putting up a stinker. Oh boy.
Yeah, no. I don't think he even played that first game back because he was too busy.
Busy.
He was too busy.
Let him. That's the only time I've seen the guy smile.
At the White House.
And at the clubs in Miami.
I mean, you did just win a gold medal. Come on. Like, it's not like...
Then he has to come back to Toronto? Oh.
That's not going to be fun.
It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate.
Right, yeah.
Feeling good? I feel like we've covered it all.
I feel like we've covered everything there is to cover.
Boy. All right, that's been it, I think. Pretty sure we'll be on the sixth episode of 2026.
Think so.
Yeah, it's been it. That's been me, Nathan Pagliaroli, with Frankie, and that is Golden Bold.